I've already been meeting some of you this morning. It'll take me a while to get everyone's name fixed in mind, but I'm glad to be able to talk with you. And the lesson that I've announced, the focus of conflict. First thing I want to do is to make the point that there is a conflict that is going on. A lot of Christians are not really aware of that conflict. They're especially not aware of the part that each one of us has to play in that conflict. There's a spiritual conflict that is going on in the world. This spiritual conflict has been going on since the beginning of time, since the serpent beguiled Eve in the garden. Ever since then, that conflict has been going on. The passages, the scriptures tell us clearly about this conflict. Peter wrote in 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, "Be sober, be vigilant. Your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour." We also read in the book of Revelation, particularly the idea that this spiritual battle is real and what the spiritual battle consists of. It is not really primarily the conflicts that you and I have with the devil, but it's the conflict that God has with the devil. It is because of that conflict between God and the devil that you and I have conflicts as well. So that battle is the primary one. And it is because of that primary battle between God and the devil that we have the conflict with the devil as well. So we know that there is this struggle between good and evil. And as I say, the book of Revelation helps us to see that as well. Particularly, I think that's one of the valuable things about the study of the book of Revelation, is it shows us the true nature of this struggle. The combatants on the part of the evil, they are particularly ugly, vicious beings, symbolized, for example, by the great red dragon in chapter 12 of the book of Revelation. Paul wrote, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are mighty before God to the casting down of strongholds." So here is another passage making that point. Another one that I'd like to refer to is Ephesians chapter 6, where Paul talks about the fact that we do not fight against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the royal rulers of this darkness, against the spiritual host of wickedness in the heavenly places. That's Ephesians chapter 6. So all of these verses, all of these passages that we've looked at help us to see that there really is a struggle that's going on. But you know, the point that I want to make is not so much there is a struggle going on. I think that we would all pretty well agree with that. The particular idea that I want to discuss with you today is what part do I play and what part do you play in this struggle? So now I want you to really concentrate. I want you to really think with me now about this. Because what generally happens in any group is that we spend the first few minutes getting here. And then we spend the next few minutes changing gears. And I feel like we're still changing gears. And we're going to have to really, really bend our attention to the things that are being said and really get into it. Because you see, this lesson that I'm talking about is not just academic. It is real. And if we do not understand the truth of what I'm saying to you today, we will be on the losing side in this battle. So I want you to take it very, very, very seriously and very carefully. So the point that I'm making is not just that there is a struggle. More particularly, I want to look at what your part and my part must be in that struggle. You may have heard of the battle that went on back in the days of Napoleon. Napoleon was the leader of this tremendous army. Well, at the same time, his greatest enemy, in a way, was Great Britain. They had the greatest navy in the world. So here Great Britain had the greatest navy in the world, and Napoleon had the greatest army in the world. Now, do you see a problem there? How is an army going to fight a navy? How is a navy going to fight an army? So there was a problem in having a joining of forces. Where could this conflict actually meet? Where could the force of the navy be brought to bear against the force of the army? And so that was the problem. And so it is a problem in the battle between good and evil in our lives. How does that battle take place? Where does it take place? It does not take place out here in the plains. It doesn't take place out here in nature and so on, things like that. It takes place in our lives and in our hearts. That's where it takes place. So you have to understand that that's where the battle takes place. So I'm going to be a part of that battle. You're going to be a part of that battle. And we have to accept that here's my part in that battle. There are several stories in the Bible that I want to refer to today as we talk about this idea of the conflict, the focus of conflict. The conflict must be brought to bear. That's why I call it the focus of conflict. And one of the stories that I like to use in talking about this is the story recorded in Daniel chapter 3. In that chapter, we have the story Nebuchadnezzar had set up a statue, an image, in the plains of Dura. It was 90 feet tall, 9 feet wide. And Nebuchadnezzar set this great statue up. And he gave the command. He said, "Now, at whatever time you hear the royal music play, you are to bow down and worship this image that I have made." And the idea was that here was the king, and he was saying that when everyone hears this music, you are to bow down and worship the image that I have made. And he had all of his deputies and satraps and officials and nobles, they were all there. So at the time you hear the royal music play, you are to bow down and worship the image that I have made. And so sure enough, when the music was played, everybody bowed down to the image. It was the kind of thing that it's like the wind blowing across the field. You can see where the wind is by the way it's bending the grass over. And I'm sure that if we had been there to see this, we would have seen the music, we would have heard the music play, and then we would have seen everybody just falling down, just bowing down. But in all of that assembly, there were three men that would not bow down. Now, at this point, you and I would say, "Yeah, I sure wish I was brave like they were. They didn't feel one twinge of fear." No, you're not thinking right about that. We're not thinking right to say they didn't feel one twinge of fear. They didn't feel any kind of butterflies in the stomach or anything else. No, where you have courage, you have to have fear. And for courage to work, you have to have faith. So, as these men stood there, they knew well the consequences. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They knew well the consequences. But they stood anyhow. But now really and truly, you see, what happens is you and I take a story like that and we put a big wall between us and them. Because when I am facing conflicts in my life, I sometimes feel afraid. I get nervous. You know, I get worried. What are the consequences going to be? And I'm kind of scared about it. And we think they didn't feel any of that. And then we say, "Boy, I wish I could be like that." No, let's remove that barrier and realize that we share with them. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they knew fear. They were nervous. But nevertheless, they did not bow. And so there were certain of the Chaldeans then that came to Nebuchadnezzar. And they said, "O king, live forever. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed to high places in the provinces, and they have not bowed down and worshipped the image that you have made." And they told him who it was. Oh, he was angry. He was furious. And he commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought in before him. So they came in, and he said, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, is it of purpose that you have not bowed down and worshipped my image?" Now, you must remember that I said that at whatever time you hear the royal music play, you are to bow down and worship my image. And if you don't, then what God can deliver you out of my hand? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, "O king, we have no need to answer thee in this matter." I'm going to just sort of explain what I believe the meaning of their response to the king was. I think that basically they knew that this is not the time for us to enter into a prolonged discussion about God and what our part in all of this is, and whether God was going to deliver them or not in a miraculous way. They had no idea about that. So they just said, whether our God chooses to deliver us or not, know this, O king, we will not bow down nor worship the image that you have made. Now there it is again. And again, you can imagine that they were plenty nervous and afraid. But they had the courage of faith, and so they hung in there. So Nebuchadnezzar was so angry, he commanded that the furnace be heated 7 times hotter than usual. Now, they did not have thermometers back then. So it wasn't that literally that whereas the furnace is usually 500 degrees, we're going to make it 3,500 degrees. The point is, let's make it as hot as we can possibly make it. Now, if you've ever dealt with a stove that burns wood or something like that, you know that if you allow draft to go through that stove, you can really heat it up. And with old fireplaces and things like that, you can get a fire going up that chimney and catch the house on fire. You can get it so much hotter. So anything with the air going through it, you can really increase the heat. So that must have been what Nebuchadnezzar did. Plenty of fuel, plenty of air going through that thing. And then he commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be bound. That they be bound, fully clothed as they were, and that they be cast into the furnace. And so urgent was the king's command that not only was the furnace heated so hot, but certain mighty men of his army took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they were bound in all of their clothes. And that point is made especially because of what happened. So, the strong men, the mighty men, took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They cast them into the furnace, and in so doing, they were killed, they were slain by the fire. The mighty men who cast them in were slain by the fire. So fierce was the heat, and so on. Meanwhile, Nebuchadnezzar had seated himself out here in front, where he could watch these three men fall down and burn to a crisp in the midst of that furnace. Now, that had to be a whole lot of hatred guiding him. So there he was, ready to watch these men burn because they had the effrontery to disobey him. And suddenly, his anger dissipated and was replaced by another sensation. Because as he looked in there, he said, how many did we cast in? They said, 3, O king. He said, then how is it that I see 4? And the aspect of that fourth one is like a son of the gods. There were now 4 men or beings walking around in that furnace. In the midst of that inferno, there were 4 beings walking around. Now remember, they were bound when they were thrown in. But they're not bound now, because the ropes with which they had been bound were completely burned away. And yet they themselves were not hurt at all by the fire. So they were just walking around in that furnace. The fire was not able to do them any harm at all. And I mean, you imagine what it would be like to have that experience, to be standing in the midst of that inferno on those white-hot coals on the floor, and there they were, just marching around, walking around in that. Nebuchadnezzar said, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, come forth. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came walking out of the furnace. And as they came walking out of the furnace, I've often imagined that too. The Bible says that Nebuchadnezzar had come near to the mouth of the furnace and had peered in. He had seen them. He calls them out. And now they come walking out to him. So as they come walking out to Nebuchadnezzar, the heat would have been so great that he couldn't have been too close. And so they come walking out, walking out, walking across those white-hot embers as they move to the front where they're going to come out of the furnace. They come out of the furnace. They come walking up to Nebuchadnezzar. And by this time, the deputies and satraps and other nobles had gathered in around where Nebuchadnezzar was because they were amazed as they looked at these men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Because the fine clothing that they had on was not even scorched. The hair on these men was not even singed. There was not even the smell of fire about them. And Nebuchadnezzar looked at them. And then he made a decree. He said, I, Nebuchadnezzar, make a decree that anyone who speaks a word against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be put to death, and his house will be made a dunghill, because there is no other God able to deliver after this manner. Now the interesting thing to think about, there are several interesting things to think about in this story. One, Nebuchadnezzar believed in gods. It wasn't that he was an atheist. He believed in gods. But like all pagans, like all idolaters, there were definite limits on what their God can do. And so he would say, yeah, gods can do things, but what God can deliver you out of my hand? He did not think there'd be any God that could do that. And now that Jehovah the Lord had delivered them, he was so amazed. He says, there is no other God able to deliver after this sort. Now I want you to think about this story. And I want to ask you some questions and then let's draw some conclusions. Some of them you may have already thought about. Others you might not have. Now you have to apply this to yourself. I apply it to myself. I want you to apply it to yourself. Put yourself in their place. Anytime you've had a decision about what am I going to do? I'm put under pressure to do wrong. What am I going to do? And I know that at some point every one of you has been in that position. I've been in that position. So I really want you to think seriously about that. Now, here's the first question I want you to consider. When would you say that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego won their victory? Now, you know, the temptation at first would be, well, it was when they came walking out of that furnace alive. No, that wasn't it. And it wasn't when they were cast in. No, let's go back even before that. They won their victory when they heard what the king said had to be done, and when the music played, and they did not do it. They refused. They made up their minds. When they made up their minds. And listen, that's when it's going to happen to you. You have to make up your mind. Now, see, here's the deal. When the forces of right and wrong come together, they're going to come together in your heart. They're going to come together in your mind. They're going to come together in your life. Now that's the point I was making earlier. The thing I want you to understand. It's not going to be something that takes place out on a literal battlefield where you can observe it taking place out there with cannons firing and all of that. No, it's going to take place in your heart. It's going to take place in your life. When you are faced with decisions of right and wrong, and the harder the decision, the heavier the cost to be paid, the more difficult it will be to make the right decision. Now, you can when you're faced with that choice, here's what you can do. You can either say, I'm just not going to do it. I'm just not going to make a decision that's going to put me in the fire. Well, now listen, don't you realize that if that's what you say, you have made a decision? When you make the decision, I'm not going to fight, I'm not going to stand, you have made a decision. And you have decided that you are not going to be that scene where the conflict is going to take place. You're going to give up without a fight. You're going to let the devil win the day. For God to win the day, there has to be a conflict, and there has to be somebody who's willing to let his life, his mind, her life be the battlefield. Let me pause this story to tell you another one right quick, which will really focus this point. The story is Job. Now, most people think that Job was about suffering. But actually, in a way, suffering and the sufferings of Job merely furnished the stage upon which the play was enacted. The issue of Job was not really the suffering that he underwent. The issue of Job is set forth in the very first chapter when the devil came before the Lord. And as the Lord said, "Job, have you considered my servant Job, how upright and faithful he is?" And the devil replied in Job 1:9, he says, "Doth Job fear God for nothing?" So that the argument of the devil was that the only reason Job serves you is you have bought him. You have bought his service. You have bought his fear. He fears you because you have given him all of these riches that he possesses. His big family and all of the animals that he possesses. You have bought him. He doesn't fear you for nothing. That was what the devil was saying. Now, watch it. Are you seeing the sides being drawn here? The devil is saying, he doesn't fear you for nothing. He fears you only because you bought his service. God, who on numbers of occasions in Job refers to Job as my servant, says, "Satan, you're wrong. Job serves me because of other reasons." And I believe that the lesson of Job is that we are to serve God above all for the reason that He deserves it. Aside from any personal reason that you or I might have. You see, this takes service to God on a higher level than we usually even think of it. That's one of the great things about the book of Job. It takes serving God and the reasons for serving God to a level higher than we usually even think of. The primary reason for us to fear God and to serve Him and to worship Him and to adore Him is He deserves it. He is worthy of it. So who's going to turn out to be right? Because God felt that Job would do that. So Job, God is saying, "I believe that this is the reason why men should serve me, and I think this is why Job serves me." The devil says, "No, that's not the reason. He serves you because you have bought him." Now do you see there's a conflict there? Now how is that conflict going to be resolved? How is the conflict going to be met? Only if Job is willing to do what he should do. Because if he's not willing to do what he should do, then what will happen is that when the devil has taken away all of his possessions, all of his animals, his children, caused his wife to turn against him, taken his health away, then Job will just give up and it'll be over. There was no conflict in that case because Job just gave up. And in that case, the devil won and God lost. But Job did not do that. Now, Job did not know what you and I know about the story at this point. He did not know what was going on. He didn't know why all of this was taking place. But he only knew that he was not going to give up his relationship with God. And through thick and thin, he clung to that relationship and would not give up. And so he remained faithful. He remained faithful to God and did not give up. Therefore, God won. Now, the thing you and I need to remember about Job is that when we are engaged in trial, when we are engaged in suffering, we may not know what all is going on. Now, the issue was pretty clear cut with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But so often, the issue may not be clear to us. What's behind all of this? We may not know that. Job did not know it. So it is so important for you and me to realize that whenever I am in a conflict between right and wrong, when something is happening and I'm being tempted to do wrong, I at least know who the sides are. They're God and Satan. It's right and wrong. And I may not know the background. I may not know why. But if I remain faithful and I resist evil, and I resist the temptations of the devil, and I don't give in, the conflict takes place in my life then, and in my heart and mind, but God wins. And so back to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. When they decided we are not going to bow down, that's when they won the battle. Now let me ask you another thing to think about in connection with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Suppose they had been cast into that furnace and they burned up. They burned to death. Then we would say, oh wow, they lost. No, they would not have lost. Even if they had died in the furnace, they would not have lost. You see, the world has a way of looking at things differently than God, differently than we should. You do realize we're not going to get out of here alive. Death is going to come to us. It is appointed unto man once to die, and after this the judgment. So the thing is to be ready for that day. And when that day comes, death... Remember what Paul wrote about death in 1 Corinthians 15 at the close of that chapter? Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy victory? Where is your victory? Taunting death. When Jesus died on the cross, did he lose? You see? No, he didn't lose. I think about Paul. The Bible does not tell of his death. But according to 2 Timothy, he had been taken captive by the Romans the second time and was now facing death. But I think about the Apostle Paul when he went out to meet his death. Did he lose? Was he a loser? No, he was not. So even if Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had burned up, had died in that fiery furnace, they would not have lost. They won. So you and I have to kind of rethink our way of determining whether the victory is won, whether we overcame or not. And the longer I go in life, the better heaven looks. The better heaven looks. And so what matters more and more, what matters is whether you do allow this conflict to take place in your heart and life by resisting evil rather than giving in to it. Oh, this comes in all kinds of packages. It may come on what appears to be a fairly superficial level when we are in a position where it would really be handy to tell a lie. It may be at school. You know, even fairly young, you will begin to be a part of this struggle. And it would be convenient to tell a lie. So do you do that? Sometimes a man or a woman who is married, sometimes a man or a woman begins to do some things, to play around, to do some thinking, some talking with someone that's going to lead to problems. Maybe there are some things that they use to justify this. But they begin to do the things that are going to lead them to be unfaithful to their partner. And they know they're doing wrong. And here the temptation, the issue of temptation is clearly there. What are they going to do about it? Well, there's another story that we're going to put in with this group. Another story, and this one is about a man named Joseph. Now Joseph was sold as a captive when he was 17 years old. He had been the favored son of his father, and his own brothers turned against him. God had given Joseph dreams which indicated that he would rule over his brethren and over his family someday. These dreams were not from Joseph, they were from God. Joseph was as mystified by these dreams as anyone else. When he told his brothers, perhaps just to see if they had any explanation, he couldn't see any other explanation, but they turned against him, and they were jealous of him because his father loved him better than the others. And so they sold Joseph into captivity. 17. Now listen, you young people, those of you still at home, you realize that probably you're here today primarily because your parents say that here is where you need to be today. Now I hope that you think it's a good idea to be here today too. But the day is going to come when you're not going to be with your parents. The day is going to come when you're not going to be with your parents. You're going to go off to school, for example. And you know what? There will be that first Wednesday night or that first Sunday morning after you have gone off to college where for the first time in your life, Dad and Mom are not there to say, "All right, be sure you're ready. It's time to go. Let's be ready to go now." Oh, they're not there. It's going to be purely up to you to decide what you do. What are you going to do? Are you going to show that I have not learned anything? I have not learned to believe and love the Lord God. I have done what I've done only because Mom and Dad made me do it. You're going to find out what you're made of. You're going to find out what your principles are. Do you have any principles? Well, Joseph was without Mom, without Dad. And he was in a hostile environment. Sold as a slave in Egypt to a man named Potiphar. He began to serve in Potiphar's house. As he served in Potiphar's house, he was very efficient, did a very good job with whatever he did. And as he worked, Potiphar's wife began to cast her eyes upon Joseph, for he was a very handsome man. And as she looked at him, she began to desire him. So she said to Joseph, "Come to bed with me." That was a flattering thing for a slave to be told that by the master's wife. And Joseph, oh my, what all could Joseph have said? He could have said, "Well, it's obvious. I mean, why should I do anything that's right? It's obvious God doesn't care anything about me to let me be sold as a slave. So what do I owe God?" You know, he could have said that. He could have said, "There's nobody here who cares what I do or who knows what I do. I don't have any family here. I don't have anybody here. Nobody that loves me is here. Who cares?" He could have done that. That seems to be a tempting thing to a lot of people when they're off somewhere by themselves in a new area, starting a new phase of life. But instead, Joseph said, "I can't possibly do this thing. My master has turned everything over to me. He's put everything in my hands. He doesn't keep up with anything that goes on here except what he eats from his plate. He hasn't turned you over to me because you are his wife. So how can I do this great evil and sin against God?" Now that means there was one that Joseph recognized was with him. And that was God. Joseph was a man who carried God with him everywhere he went. He was not of the disposition that when you leave your hometown, your home congregation, you leave God there as if He's a local deity. You know, isn't it amazing how we act like idolaters? Have you ever thought how we act like idolaters? We pretend that, "Oh, we believe in the God of the universe." But we act like He's the God of the local town where we live in the local church. When we go off somewhere, we leave the local deity back there. Well, Joseph didn't do that. So he refused to commit fornication with Potiphar's wife. Some time went by. He got to where he would not even be in the house with her. Now that was a good thing because, you know, a lot of people like to play with temptation. They like to play with it. But he would not play with it. He would avoid her. One day, the other servants were out of the house, and Joseph was in the house with her, and she just laid hold on his garments and said, "Come to bed with me." And Joseph just slipped out of that outer garment and ran out. He ran out of the house. He did what Paul said, flee fornication. That's exactly what he did. But that was a problem because now he had left a garment in there with her. Now what could he do? Go back and say, "Oh, could I please have my coat back?" He couldn't do that. The servants began to come back in the house and there was Joseph's garment. What are you doing with Joseph's garment? So she lied and said, "Joseph tried to attack me." And she just kept the garment there and said, "You just wait till Potiphar gets here and I tell him about what Joseph tried to do." So Potiphar comes in and she shows him, she goes on the offense. So here's a man who tried to do what was right, Joseph. He did do what was right. And of course he's sold now. Not sold, but put into prison. But I'm not going to go on with the story of Joseph at that point. Just to remember that eventually he is where God wants him to be. And he has held up through the trials. He has sustained his faith through the conflicts. And he comes out a victor. He is made the head over all the land of Egypt. His dreams come true just as God had indicated they would. So once again, we see that here is one who was in a circumstance where who would care if he did wrong? But God would care. And so Joseph refused to give in to that. So in the case that we started with, in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they made up their minds that they would not do wrong. They were willing to be the scene of the conflict to take place, and therefore they honored God. And for you and me to honor God, we're going to have to do the same thing. In the Bible, there are so many instances of this. And I've thought about Daniel as one that I like to use. And the simple story is told about Daniel in Daniel 1:8. He purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. Now the reason why I like to use that little expression right there is because it applies to every one of these stories. He purposed in his heart. He made up his mind. That's what you have to do. You make up your mind that you are not going to be involved in all of this. That you have to make up your mind that you are not going to back off. You're going to be a part of this. You're not going to do the thing that is wrong. You know, for you to be a part of this conflict, there are certain things that are going to have to happen. You're going to have to be willing to be the focal point of the conflict between good and evil. You have to love God even more than you love your own life. You have to be committed to the keeping of God's way and making it number one. And if you do that, then through you, God will be glorified, just as He was through them. When Jesus was tempted of the devil, there were three points that he made in answer to the temptations. The first one, the devil came to him after Jesus had hungered for 40 days and 40 nights. He came to him and he said, "If you're the Son of God, command these stones that they become bread." And Jesus said, "Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." And the point that Jesus was making there was a point regarding priorities. You have to decide what your priorities are. And God must come first. One of the things that I like to do sometimes with people is to say, let's write a list of the necessities of life. Let's just draw a list of the necessities of life. So you can kind of help me, and let's do this. All right, so we have number one. Number two, number three, number four. That ought to be enough necessities. Now, what are the necessities? What's the first one? Well, we could say Let's don't say air, even though it is. Let's say food. But not number one. Let's put food here. And let's say shelter. And even though you would get the impression that a lot of people are not of this opinion, clothes. Now, that was Israel's list. That was Israel's list. Except they had put everything up one notch. First, food. Second, shelter. Third, clothes, something like that. And so when Jesus was facing the devil, he was referring to old Israel back there in the day when they were complaining about not having food and we're needing bread, we need bread, we need bread. And Moses said in Deuteronomy 8:3, the Lord suffered you to hunger and fed you with manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known. In other words, you think bread's going to solve all your problems. No, God can feed you in ways you don't even know. No, the first thing you know, the first thing you need is to obey every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. In other words, you need to commit yourself to the following the ways of God. So that first one is priorities. Second, the devil took him into the holy city. Took him up on a pinnacle of the temple. He said, cast yourself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge concerning thee, and on their hands they will bear thee up, lest haply thou dash thy foot against a stone. And Jesus said, again, it is written, thou shalt not make trial of the Lord thy God. So the second temptation has to do with the idea of not trusting in God and constantly requiring God to prove himself. You know, there's got to be a point where faith becomes real. And God had demonstrated his reality and power over and over and over again to Israel. But Israel still did not know. They did not believe in God. And they had the audacity to say, is the Lord among us or not? You mean you don't know whether he's among you or not? You mean you haven't seen any evidence of his presence? Who brought the plagues on Egypt? Who divided the Red Sea? Who sweetened the waters of Marah? Who made the water flow out of the rock at Rephidim? Who was it that gave you the manna in the wilderness of Sin? Who is it whose presence is before you at night in the pillar of fire and in the day of the cloud? And you say, is the Lord among us or not? You see? And so the devil was wanting Jesus to say, well, I don't know whether God will do what he said or not. I guess I'll have to jump and see. Well, if Jesus doesn't know whether he can trust the Father, then how could you and I know whether to trust him or not? And he did not fall for that temptation. You see, there was a conflict going on there in his life between good and evil. In fact, here was deity faced with Satan. And that conflict was taking place. And finally, the devil took him to the top of an exceedingly high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, and said, all of these things will I give you if you will fall down and worship me. You know what? That's what it's all about, really. Because ultimately, it's choosing whom you're going to worship. It is choosing whom you're going to fear. Choosing whom you're going to serve. And Jesus said, get out of here, Satan, because it is written, you shall worship the Lord thy God, and him only shall you serve. And then the devil left him. You might also remember, I'm going to close with this passage. You might remember the statement in the Old Testament, very famous statement. But so often, I think that we don't really notice the context as clearly, perhaps, as we should. And that is in Joshua 24, choose you this day whom you will serve. Let me tell you just a moment about the context of that. What Joshua was telling the people was this. If you are not going to serve the Lord, that's what he says. If you are not going to serve the Lord, then choose you this day whom ye will serve. whether the gods of your fathers that they served beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land we dwell. Now if you'll think about those two choices, what's the difference? They're idols. They're false gods. So you see, if you're not going to worship the Lord, the only thing you have left to choose from is that which is false. And so you might as well choose one as the other. And then he said, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That's the choice we will make. Okay, we will stop for this period of our study now.